Swan Song by Kelly Greenberg Jeffcott. Read by Deborah Weston. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. The princess is caged in the consulate. The man with the candy will lead the children to the sea. The naked woman on the ledge outside the window on the 16th floor is a victim of accident. Or the naked woman is an exhibitionist, and it would be interesting to know which. We tell ourselves that it makes a difference whether the naked woman is about to commit a mortal sin, or is about to register a political protest, or is about to be, the Aristophanic view, snatched back to the human condition by the fireman in priest's clothing, just visible in the window behind her, the one smiling at the telephoto lens. We look for the sermon in the suicide, for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely, especially if we are writers, by the imposition of a narrative line upon disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria which is our actual experience. Or at least we do for a while. Joan Didion, The White Album. Chapter 1, 1974. Theme. For the first time in his life, the words refuse to come. He lies in bed, propped on a pile of chintz pillows, their suffocating tangle of tea roses faintly reminiscent of a southern grandam's parlor. We've each mused, at one time or another, that somewhere beneath his gnarled gnome exterior lurks a genteel New Orleans matron, mortified by her host form's crassness. He stares vacantly at the page before him, thoughts elsewhere, on delivery dates he hasn't met, on advances already spent, on the Fabergé paperweight he's just nabbed at auction, how it changes hue when the light shines through it just so. Citrine tones conjuring babe's miniature vegetables, darling little carrots that only grow so big. On the 800 pages of lies he has or hasn't told, depending on who you ask, depending on what he said and to whom. For all his boasts to the contrary, the paper, curled around the barrel of the Smith Corona, balanced on his protuberant stomach, is barren. A stack of sunny legal pads proves equally unfruitful, his spider-like scrawl more scribbled through than not. He reaches for an ashtray full of half-smoked cigarettes and grabs his pack of Trues, a brand he's sworn to each of us had been named after him. He trembles as he lights one, causing the flame to quiver before he sucks the nicotine into his lungs. He runs a hand through his tissue-fine hair, a gesture of old when a mop of thick corn silk fringe swept across his forehead. The fringe, like so much else, is long gone, with only a habitual gesture to remind us of the tow-haired boy we once adored, a boy pampered and indulged well into middle age, courtesy of his unquestioned genius. In Madras pajamas and ratty pink cardigan, the aging Wunderkind seems less the literary lion, less still the social barracuda of public perception. Alone in a darkened room, stripped of bravura, he looks like what he is, just a pissant rugrat from Monroeville, Alabama, shit-scared as ever. His phrase, not ours. The tiny terror is, in many ways, still the terrified toddler who sobbed when his mama left him locked in flea-bag motels while she stole out with her lovers. Lily May, who traded her small-town, small-time name for a more exotic Nina, a further removal from the role she never wanted, mother to the odd Lilliputian boy with the snow hair, toad face, and girlish voice, the child whose very oddness repulsed her. He'd sat, he's told us, on the big bed, chubby fingers sticky with sugar from the bag of beignets that had been bought to bribe his silence. He watched her dressing as he chewed, wide eyes peering from his
Sample complete. Ready to continue?